Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is November 3, 1982, and this is my audio letter number 80. Beginning with this audio letter, I'm making a small shift in my recording schedule from the end of each month to early in the month. This change will help reduce conflicts with holidays and other problems during the course of the year. For years now, a familiar slogan has been used in the advertisements for a popular pain reliever. The slogan was so effective that it helped build annual sales of nearly $500 million. The pain reliever became number one in America with 37% of the market. And yet, for weeks now, this famous slogan has been heard no more. The slogan was, "Trust Tylenol. Hospitals do." Literally overnight, just a month ago, Americans by the millions stopped trusting Tylenol. A number of people in Chicago had suddenly died after taking extra-strength Tylenol capsules. By October 1, six were dead, and a number of others gravely ill. A few days later, the death toll rose to seven. The Tylenol capsules which they had taken had been contaminated with one of the deadliest of all poisons, cyanide. Instantly, headlines about the Tylenol massacre pushed all other news stories into the background here in the United States. A nationwide alert went out for people to stop taking Tylenol capsules until further notice. Everyone was told to look for two suspect batches of Tylenol, identifiable by their serial numbers. The booming Tylenol capsule production line was shut down. The manufacturer launched a Tylenol capsule recall program. Many Tylenol products were withdrawn from drugstore shelves, and those that remained were shunned by frightened customers. Thus began a news story which has remained on everyone's tongue for a solid month. In most cases, even the most dramatic news stories begin to lose their impact after a week or so, but not the Tylenol scare. It has been nursed along week after week, piece by agonizing piece, like a real-life soap opera. First there were worries that the poisoning might have been due to some horrible production line accident. Then it was found that the deadly capsules had been poisoned deliberately. After a week or so, new Tylenol poisoning cases came to light in Oroville, California, and in Philadelphia. Those stories revived fears of a nationwide poisoning threat all over again. By mid-month, the search for the Tylenol killer was closing in on the Chicago area itself. For another week or so, there were sensational stories day after day about alleged hot leads in the case. Gradually, they all fizzled out, but only after keeping the story alive a while longer. By late in October, the Tylenol scare was at last beginning to die down in its impact. But the Tylenol massacre was made to order to spawn copycat crimes by a few unstable individuals here and there. Those copycat crimes were slow in coming, so the major media were enlisted to help set them off. Time after time, television news reports about the Tylenol tragedy digressed into discussions in the what-if category. What if the poison had been put not in Tylenol, but perhaps food or Halloween candy, said the television voices. Time after time, they pointed out how easy it would be to do that and get away with it. And sure enough, suddenly it started happening. Here and there, people received eye burns from adulterated eye drops. A man ended up in hospital after poisoning by way of a carton of chocolate milk, and Halloween candy began showing up with poison, needles, and razor blades. What had started as a Tylenol scare a month ago has become an ever-widening fear of adulteration of everything we buy for food or health. My friends, the Tylenol massacre and all the other fears it has spawned will fade from our minds eventually, but for now, it has done its job to perfection. That job was to take our attention away from certain events on the international scene for now and to turn our attention inward instead. This change was desired by the American Bolsheviks because of their failure in September to set off Nuclear War I on schedule. For the moment, the Bolsheviks here are responding by turning their energies inward to the domestic scene more intensely than before. As it stands right now, the Bolshevik-dominated Reagan administration expects to emphasize domestic matters for roughly the coming year. They want to press forward with the quiet new Bolshevik revolution here in America to tighten their control over you and me. At the same time, they also want to try to finish off their deadly rivals for power, the Rockefeller cartel. If the Bolsheviks here can succeed in doing these things, they will be in far better position to try again at nuclear war. At present, my friends, the tentative plans of the Bolsheviks here call for a new crisis sequence toward nuclear war to begin late in 1983 and culminate in war itself in early 1984. It would take that long for the military preparations for nuclear war to be recycled up to peak readiness. Between now and then, you can expect major crises to erupt overseas, which may look like they hold a threat of nuclear war in themselves. But these interim crises over the next year or so will actually have a different purpose. They will not be intended to lead in themselves to nuclear war, but to improve America's geostrategic position. If successful, this process will improve the Pentagon's chances when it is time for nuclear war itself. The process of turning inward by the Bolsheviks here is a temporary one, but very important. It must be understood if you are to understand many coming events in our economy and in politics. At the same time, we must also keep our eye on the ball and look beyond the temporary inward emphasis of the next year or so. And it is time for an important update about what the Kremlin is doing in response to all these things. My three special topics for this audio letter are Topic number 1, America's Economic Decline into a New Dark Ages. Topic number 2, War Countdown toward the Israeli Year of Doom. And topic number 3, Changing of the Guard in the New Kremlin. Topic number 1. In recent weeks, there has been one seemingly bright spot in the increasingly grim United States economy. With unemployment climbing, bankruptcy spreading, and factories idle, the stock market alone has acted cheerful. In August, the prospect of dropping interest rates became the excuse for a dramatic upturn in stock prices. Over the past 2.5 months, we've seen a series of wild swings on Wall Street that seem to defy all logic. Records have been set in trading volume on one day, only to be shattered by an even larger record on another day. Several times recently, the one-day jump in the Dow Jones average has reached record levels. One of those days was October 8th. The same day that it was announced that the official unemployment rate has reached double digits. With unemployment at levels not seen since the Great Depression, the stock market has continued to soar. 3 days after the announcement of double-digit unemployment, the stock market passed the 1,000 mark on the Dow Jones Industrial Averages. The situation we are seeing now is described well by an article released by the Associated Press in August. The article begins in the words, and I quote, "Wall Street, which waited for years for the recession to begin, is starting to act like the economic downturn is just about over. Even as companies report that their profits in the second quarter were lower than last year, the stock market has continued a rally that has pushed up the Dow Jones Industrial Average to its highest levels in 3 years," unquote. My friends, the article from which I just quoted was published in August, as I said, but not August of this year. It is dated August 3, 1980, over 2 years ago. At that time, the stock market appeared to be saying the same thing it appears to be saying now, that better times are just ahead. But, of course, better times were not ahead. The stock market bubble of 2 years ago burst after a while the economy kept heading downward. What is going on in the stock market right now is just another stunt known in some circles as a bear trap. A bear trap is an episode of gross manipulation of the stock market by certain large institutional investors to unload unwanted stocks. I first described how a bear trap works in Audio Letter 33, when a bear trap took place in the spring of 1978. Another took place around the late summer of 1980, producing the article from which I quoted earlier. And now, in the autumn of 1982, we're watching as another stock market bear trap snares its victims. During September and especially October, large amounts of unwanted stocks were successfully dumped onto small investors. Instead of setting another new record for a one-day rise in stock prices, the Dow Jones set a more disturbing record a few days ago. On Monday, October 25, the Dow dropped more than 36 points, the largest one-day drop since the crash of 1929. The excuse given was that suddenly there are signs that those dropping interest rates just might head up again. My friends, the fact is that even 1,000 on the Dow is worth only about as much as 400 a decade ago due to inflation. And the wildness of the ups and downs lately are a very ominous sign. They are a symptom of instability in the market, meaning a small stimulus produces big effects. That is what happened to the stock market in 1929, too, just before the big crash. The United States economy is fundamentally sick, and now it is having chills and fever, as reflected by the stock market up and down jumps. The two engines of our economy, automobiles and construction, are still running at about half speed. In the past, I've explained why a sustained depression in these two areas would inevitably spread to engulf our whole economy. And now it is happening. Unemployment, as measured by the government's grossly understated statistics, reached 10.1% in September, the highest since the Great Depression. Bankruptcies, too, have now reached a pace unequaled since the Great Depression. Farmers are in a tailspin, with projected farm incomes for 1982 down 24% from 1981. And then there are the banks. The Great Depression of the 1930s really began not with the 1929 stock market crash, but with the collapse of our banking system afterward. Likewise today, it is not the chills and fever of the stock market that are the greatest economic danger. It is the dangerous condition of our banks. When I recorded audio letter 44 in March 1979, I reported that the Bolsheviks here in America were going after the banks. The Bolshevik coup d'etat against their former Rockefeller allies had begun 2 months earlier with the murder of Nelson Rockefeller. And by that March, Bolshevik moles were going to work throughout the Rockefeller banking empire. As I reported in audio letter 44, they were starting at the top with the giant Chase Manhattan Bank. If the American Bolsheviks can shatter Rockefeller banking power, the Rockefeller cartel may well be doomed. My friends, the process which I first made public in audio letter 44 is now far advanced. During the first 8 months of this year, 27 banks failed here in the United States. Many others are teetering on the edge. And on August 23, it was announced that 5 of America's largest banks are in deep trouble. They are deep in the red due to the inability to collect on huge bad loans. The 5 banks, which were in the news that day, are all members of the Rockefeller Group, and one of them is none other than Chase Manhattan itself. The problem of bad loans now plaguing the Rockefeller banks is destined to just keep getting worse, not better. The final crushing blow that could bring the Rockefeller banks crashing down is the mountain of bad loans to foreign countries. Years ago, when the Rockefeller cartel had no rival in governmental power here, those loans were made without concern. Whenever loans went bad, they always made sure the American taxpayer bailed them out through various governmental devices. But now, the situation has changed. The Rockefeller cartel no longer exercises sufficient power over the whole of the United States government to bail itself out in this way. Instead, their enemies, the Bolsheviks here, are increasingly able to block the Rockefeller Group. This new situation was reflected in the World Economic Conference of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund 2 months ago. At the conference, which was held in Toronto, Canada, the Rockefeller and Bolshevik factions squared off against one another. And, my friends, the Bolsheviks won. Here is basically what happened. Rockefeller cartel banking operatives, both from America and from abroad, argued for increased quotas for the International Monetary Fund. That is, they argued that the United States and other developed nations should donate tens of billions of dollars to cover increased international loans. Rockefeller's spokesmen presented their arguments in terms of the needs of the Third World nations. But what they were really worried about was the possible consequences to their own banks of bad loans to the Third World. Increased IMF quotas from participating nations could have helped bail them out of trouble. That is what the Rockefeller Group tried to do by enlisting the support of the Third World nations themselves, but the American Bolsheviks squashed it. Speaking in Toronto on September 6th, the entity Reagan declared, "The United States cannot afford to bail out the world." What he really meant was that America's Bolshevik government was not about to bail out the Rockefeller cartel, and with that, increased IMF quotas were refused. So now, my friends, the Rockefeller cartel banking interests face an untenable situation. They hold vast amounts of loans to Third World countries, and a lot of it is bunching up and coming due. During 1983, more than $500 billion in these loans will be coming due. About 80% of that could end up going unpaid to the banks by financially troubled nations. That would add up to a combined default of more than $400 billion. If the big banks should lose even a fraction of that unthinkable amount, it will spell disaster for America's entire banking system. Very quickly, the collapse will engulf the entire international banking system as well. As major American banks collapse, credit lines to industry will be cut off. Unable to finance continued operations, more and more businesses will close their doors. Unemployment will mushroom, and the depression which we already experience will grow far worse. The public will clamor for the government to do something, and do something it will. There will be reflation of our currency, that is, more inflation in the depths of depression. And sooner or later, the entity President Reagan or his successor will declare a national economic emergency, shades of FDR in 1933. There is an ironic parallel between all of this and what happened half a century ago to trigger the Great Depression. In the early 1930s, a major New York bank, called the United States Bank of New York, a private bank, teetered on the edge of failure. The bank appealed for help to the Federal Reserve System, which by its charter is supposed to be the lender of last resort. But the Federal Reserve refused to come to its aid. The result, which was predictable, was the failure of the United States Bank. That started a chain reaction due to shared loan arrangements and other factors which linked that bank to many others. When the United States Bank failed, it dragged down others, which dragged down still others. The progressive collapse of much of America's banking system dragged America's whole economy downward into the Great Depression, and all because of the deliberate inaction of the privately owned Federal Reserve System. Today, the parallel to all this is taking place at the international level. This time, it is not just one bank, but the whole Rockefeller banking network that is teetering due to bad international loans. So the bankers have appealed for help through the international analog of the Federal Reserve System, that is, the IMF. But at the Toronto Economic Conference, the so-called Reagan administration prevented that aid from being given. As a result, the whole Rockefeller banking network is heading toward almost certain disaster. And because the linkages among banks that existed in the 1930s exist again today, the whole banking system of America and the world is threatened. The irony, my friends, is just this. In the 1930s, it was the Rockefeller interests who helped to bring about the banking system collapse through their effective control of the Federal Reserve System. That was how they acquired effective control of American banking after it was rebuilt. But this time, the shoe is on the other foot. This time, it is the Rockefeller bankers themselves who want help and who face disaster because it has been denied them. The United States is leading the world into a new depression even worse than that of the 1930s. But there is a fundamental difference between what happened 50 years ago and what is happening now. That difference has to do with our currency itself. In the 30s, times were hard, but at least our money was still stable and valuable. It was tough to earn a dollar, but if you did, you could buy a lot with it. Today, in the 80s, it's different. The dollar is no longer stable. Its value is shrinking before our very eyes. While jobs are vanishing and wages are being restrained, even the dollars we do earn are losing their buying power. The fact is that the United States dollar is being destroyed deliberately. It is this process of ruining our money itself that is leading to all the other chain reactions that are plunging us into depression. This is what I was talking about in my 1973 book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar. And the destructive tampering with America's currency is continuing and even speeding up now. A year and a half ago in Audio Letter 63, I revealed a scheme was being cooked up to do away with our present $100 bill. At that time, the plan was still in its infancy. Since then, it has continued to evolve, even though the original target date in late 1981 was not met. On the first day of last month, October 1982, the stage began to be set for action in Congress. A Pennsylvania congressman, Richard Schultz, introduced a bill which is tailor-made to Treasury Department specifications. The bill is designated H.R. 7283 and has the following long-winded title: To provide for the retirement of all United States notes of the denomination of $100 and their replacement with new notes of such denomination. As the title implies, the present version of the scheme embodies one noticeable difference from that which I reported a year and a half ago. Originally, the plan was to suddenly repudiate the $100 bill altogether. Now, the plan is instead to take away the present hundreds but replace them with new issue hundreds that look radically different. This refinement in tactics makes the plan look a little different, but it will still accomplish all of the original objectives. To see how little the plan has really changed in the past year and a half, one need only look at the bill now before Congress, H.R. 7283. The original secret plan required that the present $100 bill be declared illegal tender. Likewise, subsection C of the bill in Congress says, quote, "Such notes shall cease to be legal tender on a date to be determined by the Secretary," unquote. The original secret plan called for holders of $100 bills to be given a brief turn-in period before they became worthless. And now, H.R. 7283 says in subsection C, quote, "The Secretary shall provide for a 10-day period during which holders of circulating United States notes of $100 to be retired may exchange such notes for new issue notes," unquote. A key aspect of the original secret plan was that anyone turning in more than a modest amount of hundreds will become automatic targets of suspicion. Your name, address, and Social Security number were to be taken for investigation. And sure enough, here is what H.R. 7283 now says in subsection C, quote, "In any case in which any one holder exchanges $100 notes in the value of $5,000 or more, a record of the name, address, and Social Security or Federal Employer Identification number shall be recorded and forwarded to the Department of the Treasury," unquote. Subsection D then says that this information will be provided, quote, "to federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies for use in criminal investigation or prosecution," unquote. The excuses being given for all this are still following the secret plan I made public a year and a half ago. In Audio Letter 63, I reported that the $100 bill ploy would be justified as an attack on crime and inflation. When Congressman Schultz introduced the bill on October 1, he followed the Treasury script to the letter. In his remarks printed that day in the Congressional Record, Schultz said, quote, "The purpose of this bill is to aid law enforcement officials in the fight against drug trafficking and other crime. A side benefit would be the reduction in volume of dollars in the underground economy," unquote. But, my friends, the true purposes of the Treasury-inspired $100 bill stratagem are far different from those claimed. It is actually a power play aimed partly at you and me and partly at the enemy of the Bolsheviks, the Rockefeller cartel. The excuses of attacking crime and inflation are only a means to an end to close down America. To help protect yourself and your family in these very difficult times, I have outlined what you can do in my book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar. It is still good advice today. The main point is that you have most of your assets abroad in hard currencies, not dollars, and also you should consider the currency hedge funds in the common market, which help you to beat inflation. My friends, our money system is being corrupted and destroyed. The result is a progressive, irreversible disintegration of our economy of a kind that did not happen in the 30s. We are slipping backward in the direction of the Dark Ages. Honest, stable money is essential to civilization itself. In primitive cultures, there is no money. Everything is done by barter. That works only for very simple societies. The standardized medium of exchange known as money is essential in order to make transactions more flexible and easy. It opens a way for individuals to specialize more according to their skills. With specialization comes diversity, breakthroughs, and advancement of civilization itself. All that starts coming apart when money becomes a manipulated, unstable, dishonest commodity. The most dramatic and most ominous sign that a society's money is becoming useless is the reappearance of barter. It means that the society's normal medium of exchange, money, is not working. Today, barter systems are spreading like wildfire across America. And as it does, our civilization itself is disintegrating. Our rulers' greed for power is now leading us all toward a new Dark Ages.